This is Fresh Air. As Israel Rosenfield writes, one of the most interesting questions we can ask about ourselves is what is the nature and structure of our consciousness? Although we can't yet answer that question with any great precision, the more we learn about the complex structure of consciousness, the more we are forced to abandon many ideas about memory and the nature of thought and action. Rosenfield is the author of the new book, The Strange, Familiar, and Forgotten, An Anatomy of Consciousness. He also wrote an earlier book called The Invention of Memory. In the introduction, neurologist Oliver Sacks described Rosenfield as having a mind of remarkable range, with a nose for the most important new theories and unifications in biological science and neuroscience. Rosenfield holds an MD as well as a PhD in intellectual history, and he's a professor at the City University of New York. Consciousness is a difficult subject to discuss. I know I have it, but I don't think I could define it, so I asked Dr. Rosenfield to take a stab at it.
Well, I think without really answering that question directly, I think different people define consciousness in different ways. But in terms of my main concern, I think one of the main characteristics of consciousness is subjectivity. And so if you want to talk about consciousness, one of the things you want to explain or try to understand is the subjectivity that we associate with consciousness. And second of all, I think the other aspect of consciousness, which I'm concerned with specifically, and I think there's a long tradition to talk about that aspect as well, and that is the idea that consciousness is a kind of continuity. That is, when we are conscious, we always feel somehow it's related to the instant before, it's related to the way we were a year ago, it's related to the way we were 20 years ago, and so on. So I think the two main aspects that concern me, and I think that would concern anybody who's talking about consciousness, are first of all, the problem of subjectivity, and second of all, the problem of continuity. That is, that the idea that there's a sort of flow, and we're interconnected, as it were, with all the different instants, all the different moments throughout our lives. I mean, we sense that it's always us, the same person. So basically, the idea of flow and the idea of subjectivity are interrelated as well.
Oliver Sacks, the well-known neurologist, is also the author of the bestseller The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, has a quote on the back of your book, praising the book and saying about you, Israel Rosenfield is a powerful and original thinker who believes that the classical approach to neurology, for all its great achievements, is now bankrupt, and that it's impossible to understand states of neurological illness or health without reference to the person's ever-changing body image, consciousness, being. What exactly is it about classical neurology that you're challenging? What's the approach that you're challenging?
I think there are, in toto, one could say, the main issue is that it has ignored the whole question of consciousness. I think related to that is that one has inherited, and I think it's in a way goes back before classical neurology, an idea about memory which is false. And that is that memory is simply information stored in the brain. And I think what that fails to capture is the idea that memory has something dynamic about it, and that when we recall something or when we recognize something, it's clearly dependent on dynamic images. And what we want to try to explain now is where the dynamic imaging comes from, and why it is that you could not simply describe memory as stored information. For example, a computer could never recognize, if you stored a photograph of, let's say, X in the computer, it would really have to see that photograph again in order to recognize that particular person. Whereas any human being or any animal can recognize people or whatever from various different positions and with all kinds of changes in clothing, in hairdo, and so on. And consequently, what that means is there's something very different about the nature of memory than what we've inherited. And I think the classical view has, which continues to this day, is that basically memory is stored images, and we have to change that.
No, so neurology didn't take memory into account? Is that what you're saying?
No, the notion of memory was a notion of stored information that was static, much like memory in a computer. And what I'm saying is that, in fact, human and animal recognition could not be based on a static image. Because if it were just comparing what I'm seeing to that static image, I would never recognize somebody who's changed their clothing or, you know, somebody who's grown a beard or whatever. That is, that as they age, I can always recognize them. I might have seen somebody for 2 years, and I can still recognize them 2 years later. Why? A computer couldn't do that. So clearly the nature of memory is quite different from simply storing information, you see. And the other thing about memory is that unlike a computer memory, where one could say, I can transfer the memory from one computer to another, there's no way in which you can transfer my memories from one brain to another.
It would be interesting if you could, wouldn't it?
It would be interesting if you could, and I think a lot of sci-fi is built on that idea, I think one of the points about memory is that it's subjective. It depends. My memory depends upon me. I mean, my way of seeing the world is my way of seeing the world. If I give you that same information, you're going to see the world differently.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the brain and consciousness, and my guest is Israel Rosenfield, who's the author of the new book, The Strange, Familiar, and Forgotten, An Anatomy of Consciousness. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Israel Rosenfield is my guest, author of the new book, The Strange, Familiar, and Forgotten, An Anatomy of Consciousness. Now that we have CAT scans and magnetic resonance imaging, we can actually, the doctors, the scientists, can actually see the brain in ways that it had never been seen before and kind of see it functioning in a way that's never been seen before. What kind of breakthroughs do you think that's leading to, or do you believe that that's leading us in false directions as well?
Well, I think in a way it's falsifying the story, because basically what we're seeing was already described in the 19th century. All we're doing is seeing it in living individuals, whereas in the 19th century one had to wait until the person died and do an autopsy. And one is deluding oneself that one is actually watching a living brain. I mean, it's very spectacular to see these images, but is one in fact really seeing the brain functioning? I mean, clearly there are enormous activities going on, that is, there are enormous interchanges from one part of the brain to another, and all of this is on a microscopic level that you're not seeing at all in the scanner. So in a sense, one is really not watching the brain, a live brain, function. And there is nothing new that has come out of scanner studies. There's nothing that's been said that has not already been said in the 19th century. I mean, to say that particular area of the brain has this particular function is certainly not a new idea. The question is, clearly that area of the brain, if I isolated it and put it in a jar, would not have that particular function. It clearly depends on the rest of the brain, and the question is how. How does it create that particular kind of function? I mean, if we took the speech areas, for example, in the brain that were discovered by Broca and Wernicke, cut them out and put them in a jar, we could never make, even if we hooked it up to a vocal apparatus, that vocal apparatus speak. So what do you mean by having a specific function? I mean, clearly those speech areas depend on the rest of the brain. And what you're seeing on the scanner is, well, the speech area lights up because it's more active at that point. Well, there are other parts that are also active, and we're deluding ourselves to think that they're not doing anything at that particular point. We don't know what they're doing.
So are you saying that to really understand consciousness, you have to look not only at the brain, but at the body that is attached to the brain?
That's right. And I think that's what... In fact, when I talk about the bankruptcy of neurology, I think when you look at some of these cases, one of the things that I think was overlooked was the whole question of the body image and the way in which the brain, in fact, uses a body image when we're trying to recall and when we're trying to see the world around us.
What do you mean by body image?
What I mean by body image is that, well, to give you an example of what I would mean, if I asked you, let's say, to write the letter A, clearly, every time you write it differently, but there must be an image, as it were, or some sort of abstraction of the letter A in your brain that permits you to write it with different parts of your body, that permits you actually to recognize the letter A, even though they're never exactly the same, or in fact, they're quite different, and also permits you to draw letters that are very different and yet are always the same letter. Well, by the same token, there must be a kind of quote, let's say, image, an unconscious image in the brain, just like there's an, quote, image that would allow me to draw the letter A, there must be an image of my body. Otherwise, it's what's coordinating all the movement of my body. Otherwise, I'd fall over if it's not coordinated. And I'm calling that the body image that's doing the coordination, that's clearly very dynamic because clearly my body's moving and changing all the time. And what I'm saying is that dynamic unconscious image is playing a very important role in our ability to see and to hear and touch the world. I mean, clearly it's orienting the stimuli, as it were, but it's doing much more than that. And it's also essential to the whole process of memory.
Now, how does body image connect with consciousness? Because you talk about the connection in your book.
Well, what I'm arguing is that if you isolated the brain, as you put it in a test tube, without any body attached to it, it could never become conscious. That is, it's the body is part of, if you want, the structure of the brain. And if you want an example of that, if you take extrasensory deprivation experiments in which you try to deny the body of all sensation, you can't do that completely, but you can try to isolate it as much as possible. What's interesting about those cases is when they become almost anesthetized, as it were, that is, when they become isolated, people begin to lose the ability to perceive, and they begin to lose the ability to remember. They become actually crazy. In fact, it's a very dangerous experiment. So when you have extrasensory deprivation, what you're basically doing is eliminating the body, that is, the body image for the brain, and at the same time, what's curious is you're eliminating all ability to see the world around you and to remember. And that, in fact, very nicely shows that there's clearly some kind of connection from the point of view of the brain between the body image, that is, its own body, and memory and perceiving.
Okay. So if you think that using scanners to analyze the brain is leading us down dead ends...
Well, I'm not against it. I mean, I think one has to be careful with
right.
what it means.
Uh-huh. So what would you think is a more fruitful approach to trying to understand consciousness?
I don't think there. I think one has to be careful. I don't think there is a right way to go about this, and I think scanners are as important as anything else. We don't know. I think one has to accumulate as much, that is, try as many different ways to understand it as possible, and accept as many different odd ideas as possible about consciousness, and little by little, maybe we'll come to some better understanding of what it's all about. I don't think there's one right way to go about this. Scientific discoveries have never been that way. And it's very often the oddball idea that has led somewhere, or that is, it may even be wrong in itself, but it somehow led to an idea which was very fruitful. And sometimes it's the oddball idea that's in fact in itself very fruitful. So one can't predict.
I'm wondering, you're looking for a kind of biological, anatomical understanding of consciousness. But consciousness seems to me to be as much a philosophical or an almost spiritual concept as it is an anatomical one. Do you think that we'll ever find an anatomical understanding of consciousness?
Well, I don't know, and perhaps not. But I think what I'm trying to say is that what you're calling the spiritual or psychological notions of consciousness are as relevant to our discussions of whatever the physical basis of consciousness is. That is, we have to include that in our discussion. Otherwise, we're falsifying the nature of what the brain's all about. That's basically what I'm arguing. I mean, in a sense, I'm arguing something very similar to what you're arguing, and that is that it's not an irrelevant issue, this whole question of consciousness. You can't talk about our function without also talking about the whole question, what you're calling the spiritual side. Where's it coming from? You know, it's certainly playing a role in terms of brain function in general. And why? And we have to begin to explain that.
What most mystifies you about your own consciousness? You know, the impossible thing, one of the impossible things about studying consciousness is that you can only understand it through your own. So the dilemma of studying the brain, in a way, you can only learn as much as your own brain allows you to figure out. But are there things that just particularly mystify you?
About consciousness?
Yeah, about thinking yourself, you know, about your own consciousness.
Well, what it is, I mean, to be perfectly honest, yes, I'm mystified by what it is. Where does it come from? I don't have any idea the answer. I mean, what is odd is clearly that I believe that it has a material base, and yet I can't imagine how it sort of arises and why it disappears when one dies, which is what I also would believe. As, you know, how this thing, this enormous sense of subjectivity that I have of being alive can exist and then suddenly not exist anymore. I find it very troubling, to say the least, like most people. I have no idea really where it comes from. And yet, on the other hand, I can't believe it has any sort of external origin. I mean, I think it comes from some sort of bodily processes, and exactly how, I don't know.
Now, you were trained as a mathematician, physician, philosopher, and historian of ideas, not a neurologist. How did you get interested in studying the brain and looking for consciousness?
How did I get interested in studying the brain? I'm not as an... Actually, I'm not sure I haven't answered that question. I mean, I've been writing about the brain for some 20 years now, so I think it's probably one of the central questions of any kind of philosophical or intellectual endeavor in our own day. That is, it's the big scientific question at the moment. That is, what's the brain all about? It's so-called the last frontier to try to explain it. And so I think, like everybody else, I mean, it's something that's very stimulating, and therefore one accepts the challenge, basically.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Israel Rosenfield is the author of The Strange, Familiar, and Forgotten, An Anatomy of Consciousness, published by Knopf.